welcome to Deep Impact, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we dive deep into Wildbow's most diabolical work 5 years on. Coming up next is Elliot Diebold.
And that was Ruben Morehouse.
And we are back to talk about Arc 5, Conviction.
Yes.
The first chapter of Arc 5 starts pretty much exactly where the last Blake chapter ended. Blake is in the forest, standing over a dead body, surrounded by a number of police officers in a variety of different uniforms and roles.
Yeah. There's not really much to say here. This whole section and maybe even this whole chapter just really has a vibe of shit. Like Blake is just sort of constantly listing off little ideas and then immediately dismissing them. Like there's a sense of hopelessness, or he's like, maybe no.
Yeah. I think since this is the first chapter in a new arc, it doesn't want to get too depressing, but it would be quite easy for Blake to be a lot more desperate and cornered in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he handles himself, you know, big picture, pretty well throughout this whole chapter.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Especially when we get to some of the stuff that happens in the interrogation room. But we're skipping ahead. So Blake kind of pieces together that somebody has tipped off the police because, you know, there's like plainclothes officers, there's a, you know, like a more senior officer, there's like lab tech people. So it definitely smells like a setup.
Yeah, the fact that there's what seem to be like forensics people present really tells you that this is no accident. They came prepared.
Yes, although there is a part where one of the police officers says like, oh shit, the body's here or something, right? Which makes me think, I don't know. It makes me think either that guy's not used to seeing bodies or they were tipped off about following Blake rather than here's the location of the body. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a little unclear to me as well, but the point is it's definitely there's something going on. This wasn't a coincidence or just a karma fuck over.
The police weren't just, you know, by coincidence taking the whole squad out in uniform to a specific spot.
There's a little bit where the police, you know, as they start to chain him up, they mention, you know, he'll have access to free counsel or he can call a lawyer, and it's addressed more concretely later. But there's no way that somebody reads this bit and doesn't sort of go, well, yeah, okay, I guess that's an option. Like he might have to do that. Like I think it's very intentional that Wildbow sort of puts that seed of the lawyers as an out right at the start here, because it really contextualizes Blake not using them for the rest of the chapter.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know. It's interesting to me because definitely if I was in Blake's shoes, I know what the price is for calling the lawyers to bail me out, right? Like, we already know the price for the next favor. Or Blake already knows. We don't quite know. Assuming that it's not horrible, this is the situation where I would have called the lawyers, right?
And Blake calls us as well, but that's the whole fucking thing with these lawyers is, like, they know. It's just like they're just trying to trick him into something and you're trying not to fall for it. But it's like exactly what 4.X was talking about. This would be the easy thing to do is just do whatever the lawyers need you to do. And it's probably going to seem harmless, but it's probably not going to be.
It's true. The other thing is, you know, if I were Blake, I would have called the lawyers back when Conquest first tried to chain me up, to be honest.
I probably would have too. I probably would have been like, hey, can you guys get me the fuck out of this whole Conquest?
Let's not deal with this situation yet. I think there may be a bit of sunken cost fallacy going on here for Blake. Like, he hasn't called them yet. All right, if I can get out of the Conquest shit, I can get out of this shit.
Yeah, but it all comes to, like, it perfectly relates to what 4.X was talking about with the whole taking the easy way out. That's expressly not what Blake is doing here, and you know, that's obviously very intentional. We've just had a chapter that talks about how the reason Diabolists get fucked up is because they keep taking the easy way out, and then we have a chapter where Blake is expressly not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's doing what the book that he read that was also given to him by the lawyers, so I don't know if he's avoiding playing into their hand or playing into their hand.
Exactly. Like maybe they want him to get himself further and further into trouble, so he's even more desperate when he has to call on them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, the police officers start taking him away, boys, and kind of discussing the the possibilities of what he's done, obviously being found over the dead body of a child, is not great. And obviously Evan is tethered to his body, so Evan just kind of watches him leave.
Yeah, it's pretty heartbreaking, as Evan sort of just tries to follow along. And, you know, thinking at it from Evan's perspective, he's just been lost, scared, and hunted for months. Yeah. And now he's just made a friend, and the friend's being taken away. And you can sort of feel this desperation of he's just, like, trying to follow because he doesn't want to be left alone. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the same thing from Blake's perspective, honestly. Like, he's finally found some an ally, someone that he likes enough to want to make his familiar, and right at the cusp of that happening, oh, nope, see ya.
Yeah, actually, I don't know why exactly, but reading that in our notes has just sort of made me realize, even if Rose wakes up, she's still, like, chained up to Conquest. So, like, for all we know, she's awake already and just... Mm. Doesn't really have the ability to come and, like, update Blake. Because she was able to before, but that was before Conquest had sort of lured her in, and there's no guarantee that when she wakes up, he'll give her back.
Mm. It's true. I don't know. I do think that while he is kind of dicking Blake over, he's not, you know, denying him resources to that extent yet, right?
Yeah, probably not.
But you're right, there's really no guarantee that Rose isn't already back conscious again and just Conquest is doing whatever the hell he would do.
Yeah, and then obviously there's this bit where Blake gets frisked by the police, which makes him a little bit uncomfortable, and I think is, you know, sort of getting us in the mindset for what happens in the interrogation room.
Yeah.
But they take his, like, locket with the hair and they open it, and it may have fallen out, and it's like, they took his stash, man.
Yeah, maybe he finally will be not reliant on glamour, you know. He'll have to go cold turkey.
Yeah, because it has sort of been his trick of choice. And from a sort of meta story perspective, maybe it is time that he is forced to expand his toolbox.
To rely on vandalism more.
It was too versatile, the glamour. Like, it was almost... He was too good at it.
Yeah, he actually did... take to it quite well, didn't he? So Blake is taken to an interrogation room and is clearly being needled to be uncomfortable. And the rest of this chapter is an interrogation.
Yeah. And the whole bit opens with him sort of briefly stating, oh, I've been, like, booked and fingerprinted and I'm in the system, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then he specifies that his free legal counsel is on the way. And I think that's really important because that immediately, again, establishes that he's not calling the lawyers. So we've had that. Yeah. We've had the idea of the lawyers seeded into us, and then we've also had it seeded into us that Blake is, at the moment, not doing
that. He's not going for it, yeah.
And then, yeah, from there we have, like, all these paragraphs about how the room is, like, designed to make Blake uncomfortable. And, like, even with him, like, being aware of that, that doesn't really stop it from working. Not completely, anyway.
I mean, these techniques exist as interrogation room techniques because they work on most people, right? Like, they make you uncomfortable.
The thing about psychology is just knowing doesn't necessarily... make it super easy to fix a problem, right? Like knowing you have a phobia doesn't mean that you're just over the phobia, and it's the same with these sorts of things.
Think your way out of it,
yeah. There's also a great line where, you know, there's like the mirror in the interrogation room, which is obviously like one of those one-way mirrors, and Blake says that he looked to confirm whether people are on the other side, and looked is italicized. And I just like that as a little way of emphasizing, like, immediately as a reader, I was like, he's
the site. Yeah. it's cool, isn't it? And it's like, I looked to confirm, and yes, there were people behind this wall, and you're like, okay. I think this is such a fun setup for a chapter because, you know, an interrogation room is the perfect place to test Blake's ability to lie, in air quotes, to massage the truth, you know. It's a really fun practitioner setup to be in. I think it's cool.
Yeah, well, and it's especially good for Blake because it's a small cramped one, which plays to his other issues as well. So specifically designed for Blake. And you're right, like, interrogating practitioners is, well, I mean, this is what Blake wanted to do with the Baham children back in, like, arc 2, right? Is put them in this exact situation.
This is karma coming back to bite him.
but not that kind of karma.
The colloquial kind of karma too, probably.
Yeah, so that's a good point.
Blake starts getting interrogated. There are two interrogators. There's a younger man named Dunk and an older man whose name we don't learn. They both kind of start needling Blake, basically just fucking with him to try and get some kind of reaction out of him and open that up into a breach in his defenses and then kind of, you know, finding out stuff through that.
Yeah, because he's in that situation where his lawyer isn't there, so he's not obligated to speak, but they're doing everything they can to pressure him into slipping and saying something stupid. And again, like, he's aware of that's what's happening, and he does a pretty good job of not taking the bait, but he does kind of start to take it towards the end. I don't think he says anything too bad, but he doesn't just sit there silently like he probably should have.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he does pretty good, right? Like,
yeah,
he does basically as well as you could expect him to. He makes a little mistake where he reacts poorly when they touch him, but he does mostly quite well. But just this situation is so stacked against him. Like, not to mention the magical shenanigans going on, but Blake is just like, there's no explanation for the situation that Blake was caught in.
Yeah, like, even if Duncan wasn't there, like, Blake would be pretty screwed.
Yeah, all they have to do is hold him for a day, which is like within the legal right, and you know, something that they would probably do in this situation anyway.
Mm. And so I wanted to call out this bit where the police officers use like a slur to try and get a rise out of Blake, and he's sort of thinking about why they've done this, and then he sort of. Because they're wanting him to defend his sexuality or you know, that's sort of what they're targeting. And he describes himself as, quote, not exactly practicing straight, which is like a neat sort of idea in and of itself. Like, Blake's sort of issues with physical contact and stuff mean that he's not really interested in sex. And so there's sort of something there where he doesn't consider himself practicing straight. But I also think the word practicing is a very... deliberate word in the story, because obviously he's also, I think, partially blaming it on the fact that he's too busy with other practices, to speak.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, it probably doesn't leave much time for those kinds of things in your life when you are fighting for your life basically 80% of the time you're awake.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I want to get back to this this misstep that Blake makes. He kind of has a little instinctive reaction where he I think kind of flinches when Dunk touches his leg, and the two interrogators immediately latch on to this, realizing, oh, you know, he doesn't like it when you get up in his grill, and so obviously the rest of the interrogation is them fucking with his space as much as they can.
What a dick move.
Isn't it?
It's like, oh, because like later on, it's basically, they're like, oh, he seems to have some sort of PTSD. And then they effectively just take advantage of it. Yeah. Which is
fuck.
Right. Yeah. Pretty horrible. As I was going through here, there were like 5 to 10 parts of this sort of interrogation that I specifically wanted to pull out. Because they were like really well written or clever, and I've just had to pull none of them to save time. Otherwise, we'll be here all day.
Yeah.
So I'm just gonna say this whole bit is really intense and deserves recognition. It's great.
It's good, isn't it? I love these. The characters of the cops are so interesting to me because they are using somewhere on that scale, using the fact that he has PTSD and space issues to try and get him to confess more. And it's like, it's, I don't know, from their perspective, I wonder how they're justifying that. Like, is it, oh, this guy killed a kid, he's scum? But then Duncan knows that he didn't do that, but I guess he thinks he's a diabolist, which is basically Duncan's... the same thing in his mind.
Well, yeah, Duncan's like, he's a diabolist who gives a fuck how he feels, is probably what he's thinking.
It is, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how morally defensible their actions are here.
Yeah, I would agree. It doesn't sit well with me at all. There's probably one line I want to pull out because it stood out to me a little bit on the first go, and then we find out a bit more about Duncan, and so on the second read through, it's even more sort of important, I think, which is Duncan says to Blake, "Tell me, even make something up so long as you make it convincing enough to satisfy my curiosity. And yeah. So this is interesting because, like, if Blake lies, but it's because he was told to make something up, is that bad karma? Like, this is either bait or Duncan's sort of handing him an opportunity. So because Duncan said it, I'm leaning towards maybe it still counts even if he's told to make something up. But it's an interesting, if a practitioner is told to lie, can they? I guess is what this brought up in my head.
I don't know. I think lying in this situation is very dangerous because you become forsworn when someone catches you in a lie, right? And that's basically the whole point of an interrogation.
Yeah, but if you're told make something up, doesn't that kind of give you the okay? I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. Now, here's a quote I wanted to pull out, which I think is hilarious. Blake is thinking about the things that make him believe there's inherent good in humanity. And he thinks of the Knights, of Maggie, of Paige, of Joel, Alexis, Tiffany, and my other friends. Hell, of Evan, that tenacious little boy who'd held out as long as he had. He's reaffirming his belief in the inherent good of humanity. And Rose's name is just not on this list. I know that we joke about Blake being shitty to Rose sometimes, but this is, like, really bad. He thinks of everybody important in his life, and he even thinks of the Knights. He thinks of Maggie, someone who he, you know, who killed his cousin, and he still kind of hates. But no, Rose doesn't get a mention. That's so fucked up.
Yeah. Well, he said humanity, not vestigity.
Now, in what way do you think Rose is less human than Evan?
Like- yeah. Well, Evan has, like, a full-fledged soul. I mean, I'm not genuinely arguing this. Just to play devil's advocate, I'm on your side. Leaving Rose out of this seems either harsh or neglectful.
Well, yeah, is it just, like, out of sight, out of mind? Like, I don't even know.
I mean, that's the charitable reading that's still not very good. Like,
it's not very charitable. Yeah. I love that Maggie gets a mention and Rose doesn't. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, his opinion of Maggie definitely seems to have softened in the last arc in a bit. Yeah. I guess her attribute of not actively trying to kill him has sort of proven even more rare and thus even more valuable.
Yeah. Anyway, I just think that's hilarious that Rose is completely skipped.
Well,
eventually Blake's lawyer arrives and the officers, excluding Dunk, head out to meet her. And Duncan stays and does a little rune to give them some privacy and reveals that he is Duncan Behame, Laird's nephew. And they have a little bit of a chat on the level of practitioner.
Yeah, just in case you hadn't yet decided that this was already Laird fucking with Blake. It turns out this is all being led by his nephew.
Just in case the smugness of Duncan hasn't indicated that he's related to Laird. So Duncan basically explains to Blake what's going on. Dunk knows all he has to do is keep Blake here for 24 hours. But while he's here, they're going to cripple him, is the word that Duncan uses, I think. Mess with his friends, make his friends not trust him, make him lose his house, fuck up his life so that so that the things he can do are limited and the damage that he can do is limited.
Yeah. And so he basically confirms that, like, he's aware of the whole conquest situation. Yeah. And that's, like, so he's fine with the whole 24 hours making Blake forsworn and getting Conquest angry at him. That's all effectively part of his plan. Like, whereas Blake is sort of like, hey, you don't know what's going on. He's like, no, I do. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, totally. It's rough.
And there's an interesting bit where Blake sort of calls him out and is like, this doesn't really seem like you're talking about bending or breaking the rules of, like, being a policeman. Like, doesn't that sort of go against whatever oath or vow you probably took when you swore into service?
Yeah.
And Duncan basically justifies this by saying, well, you know, like, I'm breaking those rules to really uphold my vow. Like, if I, you know, if I break the rules to stop a diabolist, then as far as I'm concerned, I have upheld my vow to, like, protect the people.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I can kind of see that perspective a bit, but this is, like, really touching on some themes of, like, abuse of police power and stuff that's hitting a bit too close, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the points, we kind of discussed these points a fair amount last chapter in 4.x, but it is just like people hate Diabolists and it's fucked up. Like, because it,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Anyway, so here's a quote that really highlights to me how cold Duncan is, where he says, "A friendless, homeless Diabolist is easier to keep track of. If we dismantle you, then your actions reach only so far." So they're basically talking about ruining his life for a little peace of mind, you know, like, it's brutal.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
Yeah. I want to call out one other line, which I liked as just a little ominous line, where Blake's basically asking, "Oh, how do you know so much about this?" And Dunk replies, "Simple," he said. "I asked." Blake thinks, "Asked? Asked who? I didn't imagine he'd tell me." Who knows what that means?
Yeah, this is definitely one of those lines that's, you know, you, in an arc, I'm going to be like, yeah. And especially, so, you know, this is the sort of thing you put in chapter one of a new arc.
Totally.
It's totally going to tie into whatever's going to be happening this arc.
So Duncan breaks the rune that was in his coffee, and the lawyer and the other officers kind of find their way back in. The lawyer sits down with Blake and tries to understand his side of the story, which he can't really tell her. He tells her that he thinks he's being framed, and that's basically all he can say about it.
Yeah, and so one thing that sort of jumped out to me here is as Duncan leaves, he refers to Blake as Diabolist, and so using some advanced Control-F technology, I actually figured out Duncan never refers to him as Blake, and neither do any of the other police officers, and like, they never use his name, and they obviously would know his name. Mm. So I
mean, they signed him in and stuff.
Yeah, so I imagine that's part of the whole interrogation bit is...
Interesting.
You know, they never use his name.
Do you think that's to mess with him or to stop them from humanizing him?
Probably both. Fair. Like, it's definitely because they only ever refer to him as like Diabolist, or well, Duncan refers to him as Diabolist. And so it's clearly sort of dehumanizing.
Yeah. So the lawyer is very open with him that this is above her pay grade. And we get back to the beat of her saying, Blake, hire a more experienced lawyer. And Blake says, no, you know, I can't afford it.
Yeah, she basically walks in and, first of all, Blake kind of roasts her in his internal thoughts. Like, he's kind of
harsh on
her appearance.
He wouldn't be a Wildbo protagonist if he didn't roast people who are here to help him.
So he has some, like, he kind of, destroys her appearance in his head, and she basically then walks in and sits down and is like, I cannot handle this case at all. Like, I'll do my best, but it's really in your interest to go above my head. She's not really set up to be a huge asset or ally on Team Blake.
And you know, this leads Blake to say this. He says, I don't really have the option. The only lawyers I could pay would be ones I really don't want to be in debt to. And we kind of talked about this before. If I were in Blake's shoes, I would go for it, but you know.
And I mean, I think he gets a little smile from Duncan when he says this as well. So it's kind of like the one thing Duncan was probably worried about here was Blake using the lawyers, and Blake has just basically confirmed that that's not happening. So it's
definitely. So you know, the officers come back in, and the lawyer and kind of is talking to them, revealing what Blake has told her, that Laird is at the center of a conspiracy to frame Blake, and this kind of gets Duncan removed from play.
Yeah, small victories.
Victories. Small, indeed, very small victories. It is something though. It is a point that Blake has scored, right? More or less. Duncan doesn't seem too upset by it though. He just kind of rolls his eyes.
Yeah, we see at the end of the chapter that he was still like around, so it clearly hasn't hampered him that much. It's maybe made his life a little bit more difficult.
Yes. So one of the ways it makes his life more difficult is Duncan has to leave. But before he leaves, he gives the other investigator basically a tip. Get him to ask about Blake's interactions with, in air quotes, fictional creatures. The officers now suspect Blake is schizophrenic and ask him about, does he talk to aliens? Does he talk to ghosts? Did he talk to Evan before that night? And Blake kind of has to dig himself deeper.
It's a pretty brilliant masterstroke by Duncan. I got to admit, forcing it to be yes or no answers as well, really plays into the hands of the interrogators. And opening with aliens and then moving on to goblins kind of makes it look like Duncan didn't know anything. He plays it really well. He doesn't just go straight for it. He kind of misses intentionally so as to not make it too obvious.
Yeah. The other officers refer to Duncan as their best investigator at points, and it really just does feel like he kind of cheats the system in situations like this.
Yeah, he's their best investigator because he's probably enhancing his skills.
Yeah. I mean, this is a great move by Duncan, right? Like, Blake looks genuinely mentally ill.
Yeah, there's a bit where they're sort of like, do you see ghosts, goblins, grumpkins, or anything in that vein? And all Blake can come up with to respond is, I'm open-minded to possibilities, which is such a shit answer to that question. Yeah.
It earns him pitying looks by basically everyone in the room.
Even his lawyers just say, oh, this poor kid's just nuts.
Yeah. So eventually the questioning is over. Blake possibly has changed his fate from jail to a mental asylum, and he is taken to a cell, and on the way to his cell sees Evan, who is here now.
Yeah, and there's a new cop named Max, who actually sort of treats Blake like a human, like he realizes Blake's sensitive to touch, and he's like, hey, I'm not going to touch you as long as you cooperate, which seems like the sensible way to handle that situation. So
yeah, there's at least one reasonable policeman here.
Yeah, Max deserves a shout out just for not being a massive arsehole.
Yeah. So Evan's body has been taken somewhere nearby, presumably a morgue in the station, and his spirit has come along with it, and the old team's back together. Evan and Blake together forever. Rose who?
And this also seems to be the first thing that sort of genuinely catches Duncan off guard. Like, he sort of raises his eyebrows, and it's not clear whether that's, like, an interested raising his eyebrows or, like, a type raising his eyebrows, but it's probably the first thing that has caught him off guard, so that's a good sign.
And there's a line here where Blake is considering his options, and he thinks, I'd need some more help than just Evan if I was going to get out of this and seize that slim chance. And that presumably means that he feels like he needs Rose. About time?
Yeah, I guess. I actually, again, I used those powerful Control F skills that I have after this to figure out that the word Rose is not used in this chapter once. So this is as close as you can get, but I don't know if he is specifically thinking of Rose. I feel like if he was, he might have said it. He is kind of just saying he needs more. It did get me wondering, though, like, so presumably, like, I think one of the big things about having a familiar is you get to leech some power off of them.
Yeah.
And so hopefully Blake could use that to funnel the connection to Rose to help her come back quicker if she hasn't already, depending on what Pose's radiation is still doing.
Yeah.
Which just using Evan to get Rose back would be the worst, because then when Rose is outraged that Blake has signed up for a familiar without her, he's going to get to be all like, well, yeah, but I needed him to get you back. You know, he's the only reason you're here. Like, that makes it 100% okay.
Yeah.
So I hope I don't have to watch Blake make that argument to her, because it's gonna enrage me.
We'll see. There's another point where he thinks about calling the lawyers. He's been thinking about it, obviously, throughout the chapter and kind of denying it. And he thinks here, the natural answer was, I'd need to do something wrong to get out of this. Fuck that. With all sincerity, fuck that idea backwards and forwards. I was not going down that road. Blake says this with such conviction that, I reckon this is going to be a theme, this arc. Like, how much is Blake going to slip down that path?
Yeah, absolutely. As we've already sort of touched on earlier, it really ties into what 4.X was talking about. We're seeing Blake reject that easy path, and it's going to be a matter of, can he maintain that conviction? Will he be able to avoid taking the easy path as things presumably get trickier and worse?
Yeah. And we will have to see. So that's the end of Conviction 5.1. A nice setup chapter that gives us an interesting little puzzle box to play in here with Blake avoiding his arrest. So we decided we wanted to dive into some comments and see what people were thinking on this day 5 years ago when the chapter first came out. I put out a comment first by Sir Fuente, and this comment is theorizing that it's in response to a comment about how Blake always seems to just have these very close near misses to a bunch of situations. And Sir Fuente theorizes or points out a theory that he has that Blake has had another companion throughout this story that has allowed him to have so many near scrapes. Somebody who is, you know, helping out, but is going to be eaten by the erasure demon. And we're experiencing the kind of amended memory version of what has been happening in these situations.
Yeah.
I like this theory. It doesn't... Sir Fuente admits it doesn't really have much evidence beyond the fact that, like, it would be cool and therefore is going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, by definition, if there was evidence of it, then the theory would kind of fold in on itself.
Yeah,
it's definitely... I mean, as you've sort of pointed out in your notes here, does Rose not count as a companion who's helped him out of these near...
yeah, I don't know.
Near-death experiences?
Yeah. I mean, Rose has been that companion a lot, but still some near scrapes recently that Rose hasn't been around for.
Yeah, has there been somebody else helping him out in Toronto that is going to get erased and thus we don't know about?
Yeah, yeah. I just thought that's an interesting little theory to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it would be kind of cool, and it does kind of feel to me like the sort of thing Wobbo would do. But again, with the erasure demon stuff, I don't know how we'd ever know. Like, this would have to be something that would never get a hard confirmation. But it reminds me a little bit of Imp's introduction in Worm as a concept.
Yeah, true.
So you know, and that's